Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Brian Gwynn, attorney registration number 41414, and I represent Mrs. Arnold in this appeal. My brief raised three issues, but today I'd like to focus on two. I'll discuss the contract question first and then turn to the jurisdictional claim. The third claim in my brief, based on return of attorney's fees and costs, I'll rely on my brief unless, of course, the bench has questions. So the contract claim. The trial court erred in finding that Ms. Arnold had no contractual right as a member of the co-op to purchase goods and services from the Anton Co-op store. Now, it's important from the outset to recognize that co-ops are not traditional businesses. They're a totally different animal. Historically, they're this quasi-socialist association designed for the mutual benefit of its members, whereby normally it's rural producers, farmers, pool their resources and pool their talents so that they can buy and purchase goods from each other at a discount. And the key characteristic of a co-op is equity capital, also called dividends. And equity capital is calculated as a percentage of a member's participation and specifically their purchases from the co-op. And that's returned to the member at the end of the year. This is quite different than a traditional business, which is what the trial court framed the co-op as, and which is the way the co-op itself would like to describe itself in this appeal. The co-op is not even the same portion of the code as corporations. They're denoted as associations. They're exempt from antitrust, monopoly, price fixing, securities, restraint of trade laws. Therefore, today what we're dealing really with is an area of law, co-op contract law. It's not specifically corporate law, it's not specifically contract law.
Mr. Gwynn, if I could back you up just a minute. Since the court ruled here on a motion to dismiss, I assume you agree that we're judging this case by the allegations of the complaint. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what exactly were Ms. Arnold's allegations as to the basis for the contract that she says was violated?
Her membership. She had become a member of the co-op, and then the co-op told her she could never come back and use the co-op. And she claimed that under express, well, she didn't claim under express law, but the court looked at it under express contract law, that the articles, the bylaws, and Colorado statutes created a contract, a membership contract between Ms. Arnold and the co-op.
Counsel, if this is a 12b-5 motion, why are we looking at the articles and bylaws? Why aren't we just looking at the allegations of the complaint?
Well, because they reference the articles and bylaws, and because in a 12b-5, the judge is not allowed to kick out a claim unless they've determined that the claimant is not entitled to any relief under any theory of law. She clearly brought a contract claim in her complaint, and so the judge was supposed to look at the contract and determine the terms of the contract.
Well, I didn't recognize that the complaint actually referred to those. And as I read it, it said plaintiff entered into a contract of membership and provision of services with defendant Anton Cooperative. And then it says the defendant breached the contract. So is it necessary to get beyond those allegations in order to judge the sufficiency of the complaint?
Those allegations in the complaint are discussing exactly what the trial court looked at. And under contract law, when you have a contract and you don't know what the terms are, you look at the documents, what documents are before you, which is the membership certificate, the articles, the statutes, and the like. So yes, I think that's exactly, and that's why the court looked at all these documents. Now, when you look at the documents, they clearly demonstrate an express right of a member to purchase from the co-op. And in fact, if you look at any alternative reading, it simply doesn't make sense. It's an empty contract. First, if you look at the statute, the legislative declaration of co-ops, which is CRS 756 102 describes a co-op as a form of business that provides an efficient and effective method for persons to, quote, obtain services and supplies.
Mr. Gwynn, I have a question about that.
Yes, sir.
I did not see a claim for violation of the statute in the complaint. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And I'm having trouble understanding how a statute can provide a basis for a breach of contract claim. Can you explain that?
Sure. It informs the intent of the parties. If you're looking at a contract, you need to know what the contract is about. And again, under notice pleadings, Ms. Arnold, we have liberal notice pleading statutes. She said there's a contract. She really didn't even have the bylaws. Those weren't even disclosed to her until well into the litigation.
So your answer is that it informs the intent of the parties as expressed in their contracts? Do you have any authority for that?
I don't write with me, but I'd be happy to provide some in a later brief if you'd like that.
Well, that's up to you, counsel, but I'm just trying to understand the argument.
Okay. Well, general constructs of contract law would say that you need to look at the documents together to inform the intent of a contract. That's the whole point behind contract law, is to try to determine the intent of the parties entering into the contract.
But there is a parole evidence rule, though, also that limits what a court can look at in terms of to determine the intent of the parties. Normally, you just look at the language of the contract itself.
Sure, and that's fine. And I'm saying that the contract is at least articles and the bylaws.
Well, do you have any authority for that? Because I have seen cases that indicate that when someone is a shareholder of a corporation, that the bylaws and the articles of incorporation can provide the basis for a breach of contract claim for a shareholder, but I haven't seen anything in this context. Do you have any authority for that?
Well, there's not much authority out there on co-op law, frankly, but I would say that in this limited instance, the reference to corporate law makes sense because you're trying to pull together all the one or two or three documents that create the agreement and base your and look at the intent based upon those. If you look at the articles, for instance, it says that the purpose of the co-op is to sell to its members. It also says that members shall patronize the association, which means they shall purchase from the co-op.
Would there be a breach of contract claim against a member if the member did not purchase from the co-op? Is it a reciprocal duty?
Well, if they didn't purchase from the co-op under the termination clause, then they could kick them out of the co-op. Because in the termination clause, it says that if a member is not buying, then after 2 years, they can terminate them. So yeah, I think so. The bylaws also state the person becomes a member for the purpose of participating in the activities of the co-op. And the activities of the co-op are clearly buying and selling goods to members. They've operated a general store for over 50 years. It's also what Ms. Arnold has done for the 9 years that she was purchasing, and she is still a member today. Therefore, the trial court should have read these documents together as a whole in order to form an express right of a member to purchase from the store. The trial court found that there was a contract. They said there's a contract here, and they said we're going to look at the articles, bylaws, etc. They just never said what the contract was for. And that is when, under the 12b-5 standard, where you have to look at and make sure the claimant doesn't have any relief under any theory of law, how my brief goes on to explain that they should have said, well, if we have a contract, but we don't know what it's for, then we need to find out what the terms are. And that's when you can look into implied quasi-contract. You can
Well, hold on a minute. Implied contracts apply when you don't have a written contract. We have some case law that indicates that. Here we do have a written contract, and let's stick with the terms of that contract for right now, assuming that it is a contract. We're just going to assume that for purposes of our discussion. Okay. But part of the problem that we have is the contract, as you've pointed out, doesn't say in it anywhere a member shall have the right to purchase from the co-op no matter what.
It also doesn't expressly say that the co-op can take a membership fee and tell you and cut you off whenever they feel like it.
But the problem that we have is we have a bunch of rules about how we're supposed to read contracts and construe their meaning.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to find out what rule of construction you're relying on that says that we take words that are not in the contract and read them in.
Well, but I'll go back to what I just said. There's nothing expressly that says that the co-op can do what they did. And therefore, what we...
Well, wait, that's a different issue, though. That's a different issue. I'm trying to find out what in the contract says that your client has the right to purchase from the co-op no matter what.
The articles say the members shall patronize the association. The bylaws state circumstances when you can terminate membership, which, and those are, and they have to have a hearing before you can terminate membership, and that's if the person stops using the co-op for 3 years, they move from the area, they stop becoming an agricultural producer. If Ms. Arnold should be held to the rules, then the co-op should be held to the rules, and those are the three ways the bylaws say you can get rid of...
She hasn't made a claim against them for not terminating her. She's got a claim against them for not allowing her to purchase. So that's, I'm trying to hone you in on how do I get there. What rules of construction, what law do I rely on to get there?
General rules of contract construction is looking at the intent, and if you have multiple instruments, you read them together as one.
Mr. Quinn, well, the dispute here is underlaid by this series of allegations that Ms. Arnold was confrontational or uncooperative and so on and so forth with regard to employees and other customers at the co-op store. Assuming that for the sake of this question that there is a contract, what rights, if any, does the co-op have to deal with either Ms. Arnold or anybody else who is acting in such a manner, assuming that the person fact acting that way?
First, I'll remind the court that those are just allegations and the court never relied upon them.
Right, no, I understand that. I'm just trying to...
I'll say that, again, they can terminate...
But that's not one of the bases for termination in the bylaws.
Well, one thing they can do, they could amend the bylaws to address the situation. Or they could rely on any sort of criminal charges they have or any sort of restraining orders. That's fine. But if you can deal with the civil side, they should follow the contract. And this is just kind of by way of an example. You know, if I go to Target or Safeway and I cause a ruckus, I don't deny the fact that they can tell me not to come back. But if I go to the country club where I'm a member, if I go to the American Legion where I'm a member, and there's membership documents, if I went to make a drink, they might call me a cab, tell me not to come back today. But I don't think they can tell me to never come back permanently unless they follow the rules of the membership agreement. And that is what the situation is like today with Ms. Arnold. If she's going to be filing, you know, if she gave money to them, what does she get in return? Where are the rights? It's not a gift. She didn't just give them money as a charitable donation. She wanted, there are some sort of reciprocal rights here.
Counsel, excuse me, but she did enjoy the benefits of the co-op for, what, 9 years?
About, yes, sir.
Yeah. So it's not like her, there's no, I think at some point there's a discussion about failure consideration. There's no failure consideration here, is there? Because she did have the right to purchase for 9 years and to participate fully.
Well, but again, that's not in any of the contract. It doesn't say, none of the bylaws say that they can at whim just unilaterally cut her off, as the letter said. They have to follow these termination agreements, and that's my argument on that. Briefly, I'll just touch on the jurisdictional issue. Granted, the Civil Rights Act can be confusing, but this is the way the court ought to look at it. Ms. Arnold filed a claim with the CCRD under 2434-306, which she's allowed to do. She may file a claim. Then under 306-2B1A, the statute says if a no probable cause decision is rendered, then the CCRD shall advise Ms. Arnold that she can file a civil action in the district court. And that's exactly what she did. The matter should really end there. All discussions in the co-op's brief about equitable versus legal rights is all found under subsection 11, subsection 14, which do not apply here. Those subsections apply when the CCRD fails to act, essentially. And if the legislator did not limit remedies in 306-2B1A, but they did under subsection 14, then we shouldn't read in to this portion any additional requirements. And with that, I'll ask for a remand of the trial court's order and for trial. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge Miller, and may it please the court. My name is John McClure. I'm appearing on behalf of the Anton Cooperative Association, registration number 2896. Also appearing as co-counsel is Brandon Hall and Nikolai Frant. Chester Kinney and Luann Kinney, along with board member Carl Wright, are present in court. I will be handling the contractual argument and dividing the time with Mr. Frant. Thank you for allowing us to divide the time. Mr. Frant will handle the remaining issues. This is a brief history of the co-op, a little background. It's been in existence since 1950, operates through a board of directors, and is involved in a variety of businesses, including a trucking business and grain storage. We agree with the trial court that it ruled correctly in dismissing the two claims based upon breach of contract.
Mr. McClure, let me just interrupt you, if I might, and ask you the same question I asked Mr. Gwynn. Do you agree that since we're reviewing a motion to dismiss, that we must consider all the allegations of the complaint as true?
Yes.
Okay. I'm asking that because I was surprised. I don't recall in your brief that you stated that, and that there were a whole lot of factual allegations about Ms. Arnold being confrontational and disruptive and so on and so forth. And I don't recall seeing any reference at all to the allegations of the complaint.
Well, the reason that when we talked about the issues concerning her being disruptive and the difficult times that she had with the cooperative, that was in response to the implied agreement argument that was applied term to the agreement argument that was submitted by counsel.
I don't recall seeing in your brief, with all due respect, any recitation whatsoever of the allegations in her complaint with regard to whether or not there was an express contract. If I'm mistaken in recalling that, could you point me where you do have such information in your brief?
That's probably correct. We simply agreed with the trial court's determination that there it was based upon an express contract, her contentions.
Okay, well then if we're considering the allegations of the complaint as true, then could you consider, could you explain to us why, given the allegations of the complaint, the factual allegations, given that we have to assume that they're true, why then that you agree with the trial court's conclusions?
Well, if I understand your question, Your Honor, it's the complaint states that there was a contract between the parties. The trial court found that that was an express contract. And then our motion was based upon those contentions.
So did go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
Did the trial court find that there was an express contract?
Yes, I think there was an express. My understanding, the way I read the court's order, is the trial court did find that there was an express contract, but there was no right to purchase smite as part of the express contract.
And then what is your understanding of what the terms of that express contract were?
The express contract is really set forth in the articles, bylaws, and the statutes, applicable statutes dealing with co-op law, and provides a relationship between the parties, including one of which involves marketing and purchasing agreements. It's designed definitely to allow members to take advantage of the benefits of purchasing agreements and the antitrust provisions inherent in them.
So if I can add, I don't want to overshadow my colleagues in terms of questions, but let me ask one more question then. Assuming there was an express contract, what rights did Ms. Arnold have under that contract?
She had the ability to to attend annual meetings and vote as a member and vote on directors and other issues that would arise at meetings, both annual and special. She has the right to enter into pooling and marketing agreements with fellow members and to be exempt from the co-op antitrust provisions as part of that.
Thank you.
Sir.
Counsel, I'm perhaps repeating a question I asked your adversary as well, but the complaint states that there was a contract, right? It says there was a contract.
Correct.
I don't understand why we're getting into looking at various documents. Was this 12B5 motion converted into a motion for summary judgment, or are you?
It actually came up, Your Honor, on a motion for limine. Right before trial, this base issue was addressed on the contract claim.
So when the court really wasn't ruling on 12B5. The court was ruling on the evidence that was presented at that
Correct.
Time?
Correct, the evidence that could be presented at trial.
So it was, in effect, a motion for summary judgment?
I think you're correct.
And let me chime in and ask a question, because you mentioned that the contract consists of the articles, the bylaws, and the statutes, and I'm again confused as to how a statute can form a portion of the contract.
I think it just helps give some guidance. I would agree with your point. I think it helps give some guidance. I think you really look at the governing documents, which are the articles and the bylaws. We believe that there is no right to purchase, that the when looking at governing documents, it's clear on its face. And we concur with that the trial court ruled correctly in dismissing the two claims based upon the breach of contract. Concerning the issue of whether or not there should be an implied term to an express contract for a right to buy, we do not believe so. First, it was raised for the first time on appeal. The trial court had no ability to consider it. Second, if you look at the intent and reasonable expectations of the parties, if this was going to be set forth as a term of the contract, it would have been set forth specifically, and it was not.
Mr. McClure, if I can get back to the express contract issue for a second.
Yes.
Is there some difference in the language between the right to enter into pooling and marketing agreements, which you said was one of the rights that Ms. Arnold has, and the right to purchase at the co-op store?
Oh, those are two different concepts, Your Honor.
I understand that they're different concepts, but what I'm asking you is there a difference in the language in the bylaws that would affect our task in interpreting whether or not Ms. Arnold has a right to one but not the other?
Yes, I mean, it talks about being able to enter into marketing and pooling agreements. There's no language in there that talks about your absolute right to buy. Unconditional right to buy. In fact, it doesn't talk about a right to buy.
Okay.
We do not believe this should be a part of the a right to buy should be an inherent term in the contract. We think it should be there is an opportunity for members to buy, but it's not absolute. It's obviously conditioned upon behavior and actions. The co-op has
excuse me, counsel. You say the contractual right to there is a. I'm not following you. Are you saying that there is a right to buy,
but it's not
unconditional?
I'm sorry. Okay. I need to be clear on that. There is an ability to buy. There is not a right to buy.
If I put words in your mouth, I apologize.
Okay. And we do not believe that implying a term in a contract is appropriate in this quasi-contract concept suggested by Ms. Arnold, and certainly unclean hands is a defense to that equitable claim.
Counselor, I'm sorry to interrupt you again. You mentioned in response to Judge Miller's question that there's an ability to buy. Can you tell me what provision of the contract provides an ability to buy?
I don't think it's, that's a very fair statement. I think it's kind of an inherent concept that one has the ability to buy, but no different than a member of the public. The public can go to the co-op store and buy. That's all I'm talking about. And so...
So the ability to buy is not derived from the contract terms, is what you're saying?
I think that's fair enough to say that, yes. I mean, you have an ability to buy as a non-member has an ability to buy. We do think that trying to insert a term creates a right to buy undermines the ability to conduct a business. It allows difficult customers to control the business setting. And in response to Mr. Gwynn's argument that you pay $10 and you have these unlimited privileges to buy is just not there. In fact, the argument is pretty much along the lines, you could pay $10 and do whatever I want. And there's a significant body of case law to support that one can exclude customers except for certain protected classes. And there's that's an appropriate way to conduct business and to be able to conduct business and maintain some sort of business decorum and a peaceful business environment.
Counsel, I don't think your adversary was saying that there's an unlimited right to buy. I think he specifically said there's a right to terminate. And indeed, apparently there's a duty to buy because if a person doesn't purchase for either 2 or 3 years, then they can be terminated. Isn't there a right to buy inherent in that clause?
No. There is, you can either buy at the co-op or you can go to any place else that you want to. In fact, it's obvious from the facts that Ms. Arnold did that and serviced, went to other business establishments for her own business purposes. So you don't have the exclusive duty to buy from the co-op.
But if they don't purchase, then the co-op will terminate them after 3 years.
If one does not purchase, that could be a basis for doing so. It's possible. But there is certainly no right to buy. On the right, there was an argument made there's a right to accrue equity. There is no right in the first instance. That's a byproduct of purchasing. It's contingent upon a purchase. It's not as standalone right. Equity is accrued in the co-op records, much like points or miles on a credit card. It's kind of an accounting concept. An accrual of equity is not the same as paid out. It's paid out at the discretion of the board if the financial circumstances allow. And this is according to the bylaws. But I need to leave some time for our co-counsel. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Nikolai Frant, also for all of the defendants. I'll briefly address the jurisdictional issue unless there's another issue the court would like to discuss with the remaining couple of minutes. I think it's important in evaluating this issue and applying the Civil Rights Act to step back a little bit and look at a couple of key provisions. It's clear that when a claimant wants to sue for a violation of the Civil Rights Act in district court, they need to exhaust their administrative remedies. To do so, the first step is to file a charge with the division. Regardless of whether the division decides that there is or is not probable cause to think that the act is violated, the next step is for the commission to decide whether it's going to conduct a formal hearing. This is a hearing that is very much like a trial. There are witnesses, there's evidence, and the commission then reaches a decision. And as I'm sure the panel is well aware, that decision can then be appealed directly to the Court of Appeals. Now, the key section for our issue is this section 306.11. And what the legislature did with this section is said, What do we do when the commission does not conduct this formal hearing that we're talking about? And it says in this provision that in that case, the claimant can then sue in district court. The commission hasn't acted. It's had its chance. So we're going to let the claimant not be prejudiced by that fact and sue in district court. However, the key provision in subsection 11 states that the relief authorized in district court is the same relief that the commission could have awarded if it had, in fact, conducted a formal hearing. And that makes perfect sense. These are essentially parallel proceedings, and you want to get the same relief in your case. And that's important for our case because the commission for claimed violations of public accommodation rights, or violations of civil rights by places of public accommodation, the commission can only award equitable relief.
Mr. Font, is it your position that if someone wants both equitable relief and damages, that they have to start two lawsuits in two courts?
That appears to be the way the statute provides it, Your Honor. If they want to sue in district court, they can only obtain equitable relief. There is a separate section that says that in the county court, you can sue for money damages. But, Your Honor, that's really not the situation presented here because when...
It has implications for that, doesn't it?
I don't think it does, Your Honor, because the plaintiff sued only for money damages. So
it could have also sued for equitable relief as well. Could have also sued for equitable relief
as
well.
She could have absolutely sued for equitable relief.
And it's your position that if she had done so, she would have had to file two lawsuits, one in district court and one in county court, right?
That's the position, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And thanks to both counsel for your arguments. The matter is submitted